Good morning, America, how are you? Said, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Arlo Guthrie is our guest, the first hour of our program this Thursday. He's going to be performing with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra tomorrow and Saturday and Sunday. He does concerts all over the world. He just told me 10 months a year. And I told him that he's having an easier time getting older than I am because that's a lot of performing. He was born in 1947, the eldest son, of course, of Woody Guthrie and his mother, Marjorie Guthrie. I want to ask him about her this hour. A professional dancer with the Martha Graham Company and founder of the Committee to Combat Huntington's Disease. He plays, I didn't know this until I read about him, he plays, of course, the guitar, 6 and 12 string. He plays the piano, harmonica, and a dozen other instruments. He's also an absolutely wonderful storyteller, as all of us who have listened for years to Alice's Restaurant, and we listen every Thanksgiving on the way to grandmother's house in northern Wisconsin. Many of you do the same. He's done a program of symphonic arrangements of his own songs and American classics, An American Scrapbook, and he will be performing, that's a nice name, isn't it? An American Scrapbook. He'll be performing that with the Milwaukee Symphony this weekend. We're delighted to have him in our Milwaukee studios today. He's just come from Florida, and he's being welcomed by, it was -5 as I was driving in this morning, but it's going to get warmer. We have open phone lines for Arlo Guthrie. I'm sure we'll have many phone calls during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I asked you on Facebook to reminisce about concerts you saw, and we've had some wonderful responses, people who saw you, Arlo, back in the 60s in Chicago, and so we'll take some of those as well. If you'd like to join the, not Facebook, but WPR, it's WPR.org, WPR.org. Hello, Arlo. You look wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good. It's great to have you here, even though you came from Florida.
It's so freaking cold that it's not even cold.
You know, I understand that. Right. You get to the, it's just really cold. I can hardly move.
Yeah.
But it's going to get warmer. So that's good.
I'm actually fine. I love the cold.
You do?
Yeah.
Good. Well, it's really a great pleasure to have you here. And the first thing you hear about you is your voice. Isn't it wonderful that you were born with this incredibly distinctive voice, which makes you a marvelous storyteller, but the voice goes with the stories. It's just good to have a voice like yours, isn't it?
I never actually thought about it. You know, it's funny. I remember when I was a kid and recording devices were new. I mean, people had them, but not in their homes. It was like computers in the early days when the big companies had them. But my father had a tape recorder, which people didn't have in those days.
Uh-huh.
And I remember as a kid recording my own voice and listening to it and getting used to that. It's like the first time you see a picture of yourself or something and you say, is that me? And it took me a very long time to get used to my voice. I mean, it didn't sound like it did on the outside. It didn't sound like it did in my head. So, I don't know how it ended up, but eventually you sort of get used to that. And especially if you're spending time on stage, you actually need to learn how to control it and to make it sound the way, to reconcile the two things so that it sounds the same way inside your head that it does to other people.
Right. So when you heard City of New Orleans, have you finally reached the point where you know that's you?
Yeah.
You have.
But it took a while.
So you're comfortable with your own voice after all these years.
It only took 50 freaking years.
I love the arrangement of that song. Steve Goodman was a wonderful performer, artist from Chicago, but you really have done the ultimate version of that. It's a wonderful song.
You know what? It was. I met Steve in, it must have been 1970, in a place in Chicago. It was called The Quiet Night. It was a little club upstairs off this street with a train on a trestle going by. And it was owned by a buddy of mine, Richard Harding. And I remember Goodman came in one night after we were done playing, and he gave me this song. And I took it home and I thought about it, and it sat on the piano for a couple of months, and we went into the studio in L.A., in Los Angeles, to record, and that song was one of the songs that we had brought with us. And even though we had never really tried it, never done it live, we recorded it about 7 different times. We recorded it bluegrass style, we did a sort of rock version of it, we did all these different things, and none of them spoke the truth. You know how the music wasn't the same as what the words were, until finally we gave up and just said, let's just do it simple. Hmm. No big complicated anything. And the only thing that was complicated about it in the production was we had these great voices, these 4 guys that could sing like 4-part, you know, I forgot the, what do you... What
Harmony?
Do you, yeah, but what's the, you know, like Barbershop. Kind of guys. And 3 girls who just had these great voices, never been really put together before with the kind of sort of, you know, that combination. And it's in this song. And ever since, we have never been able to do it again. Hmm. You can't do it on stage because we don't travel with that many voices. But it sounds like me. We still do it in the shows. We actually have an arrangement for the orchestra.
Oh, you do?
Which will be lovely, yeah.
Oh, great.
But we'll miss the voices.
Yeah. So you did a train trip did you do a charity long train trip at some point? Is my memory serving
you? It was after Katrina.
Oh, right.
And we were trying to think of what, you know, I had sent some money. I remember seeing it on the news, like we were all watching it. And for the first time in my life, I actually, you know, took out the money and sent something to the Red Cross, that kind of thing, because it was devastating. And I thought, like, but there's got to be something else we can do aside from just money. There's got to be something. What can we do that would be unique to us? And I thought, let's take that train, the city of New Orleans. I'd been singing about it for 30 years. I'd never been on it. And so we got on the train in Chicago. And we stopped all along the way, all the way down to New Orleans, and did a series of shows just to raise money for some of the musicians. That's what we were doing. Mm. It wasn't a sort of general fund thing. It was, let's help our buddies. And then a guy showed up, I remember, with a truck full of pianos. Said, take these with you. And other people showed up with instruments and, you know, and brass stuff like saxophones and, you know, clarinets. And people just gave us stuff on the way. Until we had a caravan trailing the train. And it was one of the most wonderful. I did it with my family, all of my 4 kids and some other people who stayed with us the entire tour. And other people joined us, you know, for different shows. And we ended up with Willie Nelson in New Orleans at Tipitina's for a couple of nights. And we gave all the stuff, you know, away and all the money we'd raised and all the instruments. And I've felt a kinship to the town. Obviously, I've been there over the years, but it was nothing like this. That was a great moment.
Wonderful thing to have done, and it will always be in your memory as a wonderful.
Well, not only that, we
time.
Filmed it, and my wife Jackie filmed it, and we had a great, you know, sort of memories of it. The film went to a school in like Los Angeles or something to get edited. We've never seen it. We never got it back. But it's there somewhere.
Oh, it should be seen by everybody. Well, you have to get it back.
Yeah, we got to get it back.
Well, you do.
It's something else to do.
You travel with your family. I know you've done a concert with everybody. Isn't it remarkable? You had your dad, Woody Guthrie. We've got you. And then you have your children. And I understand your grandchildren are becoming involved in music as well.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
It's kind of crazy. It's sort of like a business at this point. You know, I don't know how that happened.
They obviously listened to you sing and liked what they saw of your life, right? So they decided to do similar things.
You know what? I never pushed any of my kids to do music. I mean, I remember giving them, you know, making them take piano lessons for a couple of months until that wore out. And I remember my son Abe was about 4 or 5 years old, and he had a big wheel, one of these plastic, you know, bike things.
Sure.
And he was going down the street early in the morning, came back without it. And I said, what happened to it? He said, I traded it. I said, what? And he had got a keyboard that he traded some kid. So I knew he wanted to do music. I mean, this was his life. And I have 3 daughters, and they have all either are in the process of making records and CDs and stuff like that, or singing, you know, and they're all doing pretty well.
It's wonderful. And then we have your father, and he probably didn't push you to do music either.
No, I think, you know, when I was a kid growing up, music was something like, is what you did with your friends when you got back from having a real job. Nobody in their right mind wanted to be a musician, you know, when in the early 50s. It was still sort of disreputable as a profession. And thankfully it still is. but more and more people want to do it. But it served the purpose of it was a way of life. It wasn't a business. It wasn't an opportunity to be somebody or to go somewhere or to do something. It was just what you did with your friends. And that part of it, I still love.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents make you take piano lessons?
Yeah. Well,
did they?
Like you noted, my mom was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company. She danced to do a lot of the material that was written by some of the American composers, Aaron Copland, for example. A lot of the original music for those dances written by him. Or sometimes we open these orchestra shows with those pieces. And so she was trained classically, and she could read and write music, and she, you know, would make us learn all the names of the orchestras and the pieces and the periods that they were written and who the conductors were and all that kind of stuff we had to know when we were kids. And, of course, I didn't have much use for it, sitting on the back porch with my buddies, you know, drinking a beer or something, playing some music. We didn't have to know all that stuff. But about 10, 15 years ago, I got together with my friend John Artalillo, who is the musical director for the event coming up, and been working with me on these things for years now. And we sort of thought it would be interesting to see if the music that we were playing, which after all comes from the same well, as it were, a lot of the American composers, Gershwin, Copland, people mm-hmm. like that, as well as some of the Europeans, the old masters, would take these folk sort of tunes from the common well of the culture and derive from them all these sort of great musical works. Well, the same thing was true here, and it's the same thing that we do as folk singers. And so we thought, okay, let's go back to the well and not have it separate so soon. See if there's something in common. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know if this was going to work or not. It could have sucked. I mean, it could have been awful. But it turned out to be pretty good, and so we're still doing it.
Yeah, great. Do you dance, too?
No.
No?
No. That's why I learned, actually, to play guitar. Because my mom was, you know, saying, Arlo, you know, you should be, although she would... You know, she taught us all of the early sort of modern dance things, you know, the things she'd learn just to warm up and stuff like that. And I haven't ever found a use for that in life.
Maybe you need to add a dancer to the symphony at some point.
Yeah, but it won't be me.
No, it won't be you.
No.
Okay, that's out. You're still alive. You could learn.
There were two kinds of people when I was a kid. There was people that was dancing and people who was playing the music for the dancers. And that was an easy choice. That was a no-brainer for me.
What else do you play? 12 instruments,
I read? Well, you know, you say that roughly. I mean, there's banjos and there's, you know, mandolins. And there's all the stuff you would know that if you're sitting around with friends and you got an instrument, you know, you want to figure it out how it goes. Doesn't mean you play them well. You know, I play a couple pretty well, but the others, I'm good enough to get by, especially if there's other people who know what they're doing.
Right, but you prefer the guitar or do you prefer the piano?
I like them both. You can't, you know, the downside of the piano is you can't sort of walk around with it. I mean, there's nobody right. sitting on a railroad track walking down, you know, with a piano on their back.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
It's not good for that stuff. On the other hand, what a wonderful instrument it is. I mean, it's proved to be useful to a lot of people over the years, me included.
Yeah, it is wonderful. This word, I'm sure this happens to you. It's just sort of like when you read a book and then all of a sudden the book is in front of you. Everybody's reading the book or you read about it somewhere else. This word optimism has made its way to this program. You know, we talked about Ronald Reagan earlier this week, and I think that Obama has been described as being in a newly optimistic phase, and the word has been described to describe you frequently too, that you're a man of hope and optimism, and that you share that optimism with your audiences. Do you think you are? And I wonder what the place of optimism is in song and in politics, and if we need that.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it that much, but it seems to me that optimism is fairly practical. It's fairly pragmatic, especially when you're in a time when that's the only option. I mean, the alternative is that you sort of work yourself into this downward spiral of thought, being consumed by the times that we live in, to the point where you get fearful and then you get nervous and you get afraid and you start defending yourself and you start doing all this kind of stuff that just sort of sucks you into a world of doom and gloom. And that, to me, is not very practical.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm an optimist, but not because I think it's a great philosophy or something. It's only because it seems the most sane choice in a world where we need people to believe that there's a future.
Mm-hmm.
You need to believe that it's worth knowing something, that it's worth the time it takes to learn something. And if you don't believe that, if you think that the threat is immediately over the hill and coming down, you're not going to spend a whole lot of time in school. You're not going to spend a whole lot of time thinking about things, developing your thoughts, because the fear is so immediate that you just want to sort of, you know, pick up the biggest gun next, you know, that you can find and start shooting it with the shadows.
I like that answer. Let's go to phone calls. We'll do them in a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We have more music to hear. A lot of people have written in on Facebook. Arlo Guthrie is going to be with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. It should be just, it's probably going to be one of those concerts that you'll remember always, like you remember the train trip you took to New Orleans. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday here in downtown Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It was late last night, the other day. I thought I'd go up and see Ray. So I went up and I saw Ray. There was only one thing Ray could say was, I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on the motorcycle.
Arlo Guthrie, our guest in our downtown Milwaukee studios today. He's going to join the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra in a wonderful concert Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'll ask you to tell, if we have time, part of the pickle story. I was watching YouTube yesterday and heard your pickle story, which I had never heard before. There's a long story behind that, too.
I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, okay, I've been on the roads. I've been working since 1961. That makes this year 50 years.
Ooh.
And of all the songs that people would play on the radio, to say "Here You Are" is "I Don't Want a Pickle." And I'm thinking, my God, have you not wrote something more worthy?
It's so much fun, though, isn't it? It makes us feel good.
Well, sometimes you just got to laugh at destiny or something.
What's the song you want them to always play on the radio?
I don't know. I'm just thinking that's probably the one they're going to remember you for, which on the one side is kind of fun because it leaves you free. Nobody's looking over your shoulder anymore to see what it is you're doing.
Right. They're going to remember Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah, they're going to remember Alice and Pickle and stuff like that no matter what.
Yeah. And that's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine.
Good
enough. Let's go to phone calls. Rick and Monona. Hi, Rick.
Hi, what a pleasure it is to talk to you, Arlo. It's just wonderful, Kathleen, that you had him on. Let's see, and I don't want to fly, just want to ride my motorcycle, isn't that it?
Yeah.
It could be these days.
I wanted to relate a story that in 1968 and 69, I was on the hospital ship repos in Vietnam, and we used to have tape recorders. Everybody had a tape recorder. And we used to relish getting tapes from back home. I remember the Beatles' White Album came in. But I wanted to tell you that one of the favorite albums that everybody had and listened to all the time was Alice's Restaurant.
Rick, thank you.
We listen to it so much that we actually, our group on this one deck, we were the laboratory, recovery room, pharmacy. We all got together and we formed a group W band. And I actually have pictures of us sitting on a bench looking ridiculous, looking like we're pretending to be hippies. And all holding up a sign that says Group W Ben. So I thought you might like that. That you had that song had an impact even over in Vietnam, and I think it was during the time when people were starting to turn against the war, even on that ship.
Wow, man, it's good. It's good to hear your voice. And you know, I've got a lot of friends over the years now that you know have got pictures and photographs of, you know, all these little tents set up in a jungle somewhere over there, and a lot of signs, you know, that say Alice on the thing. And a lot of the sort of regular enlisted guys sort of have similar stories. Most of the officers had no idea what this was about, and it was kind of funny. There was a sort of hierarchy of understanding, you might say, of a sense of humor that it took to get through those times, whether you're over there or over here. You had to smile about something because the times were so depressing otherwise. There was so much going on. People were pissed off and angry about this and that. And I thank, you know, for the guys that had the sense of humor to appreciate each other, even if it might have been a different point of view. I remain thankful because that's the kind of people we need these days, is the people that have some kind of, that are not so drop-dead serious that you can't put a smile on your face or believe that somebody, you know, across the world has the right to have that same sort of smile, that same mm-hmm. sort of sense of humor, that same sort of, let's just get along kind of stuff.
Yeah, you got to have it. You got to have it. Let's go next to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Oh, my gosh, Mr. Guthrie, I'm so excited.
Oh, right. Don't call me Mr. Nobody's done that since I was like 13.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to tell you that I love your song, your version of I've Just Seen a Face.
Oh.
Wow.
Now, that's fairly rare for somebody to have. I think that album sold like 5 copies.
I've got one, yeah.
You've got one. All right.
I do. And I also wanted to ask you, well, I wish I could ask you 100 things, but I love the movie Bound for Glory, you know, about your dad, of course, and I wonder, you know, how did you like that movie, and is it very true, and was it like that for you as a kid in that dusty town on the plains?
Well, it wasn't that way for me. It was that way for my father, and I thought the cinematography in that movie was awesome. I think they even won some kind of, you know, one of those movie award things. I didn't actually like the movie very much compared to the original book. It was one of those things where Hollywood did its thing. And so you have this sort of 6'2" David Carradine trying to portray the image of a, you know, 5'4" little guy. And this, you know, it's like the big dog and the little dog. And so all of the humor that you had of my father in real life was a really small guy. He was like 5'5", something like that. He was always looking up with this sort of little dog look, the bite look, whereas the big dogs are always sort of growling, looking down. And it sort of didn't match up. The humor didn't happen. There wasn't much humor in the film, and my father was filled with it, and his book is filled with it. Aside from that, I think it was, you know, a fairly decent film. I just think it was sort of mischaracterized, if you might say. And it leaves it open for somebody to do it again maybe one of these years.
Thank you, Sarah, very much. She's a huge fan. Tell us about, and there are probably many of these memories, but I spent a lot of yesterday on YouTube watching you, the concert that you did with Pete Seeger and others after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was a fairly emotional time, and you had some beautiful things to say about that. And I would imagine you've been in other parts of the world where significant events have taken place that it was a privilege to be there.
I'm telling you, my life is like Forrest Gump in real life. I was at all of these places. I wasn't a significant part of it, but I just happened to be there. And you see all these wonderful moments in history that happen by being present. There was, you know, I was at all of the, you know, the demonstrations that we had in the streets in the late 60s and all the way into through the early 70s. And it was all the stuff. It wasn't one thing. And when people look back on these times, they tend to separate them into sort of separate events as if they had nothing to do with each other, as if the people that were at one event were different than the people who were the next one. And it was sort of the end of the war and ban the bomb, clean the water, save the trees and the whales and the stuff, burn the lingerie, whatever was going on. You had civil rights, you had this rights and all those rights. You had all kinds of stuff. And the interesting thing to me was it was the same people that were at all of that,
exactly.
All of those things. And it was, you know, so you went from one day to talk about one thing to the next day talking about something else. But these were not separate events. They were people who were engaged in all of that stuff. And there were people on all sides of it. I remember, you know, there was people saying one thing on one side of the street and people saying something else on the other side. And I thought to myself, you know, this is... There was live music being sung as we were marching around Washington or whatever we were doing. Years later, I remember when the last great sort of unfolding of the Names Project quilt, the AIDS quilt, is what people call it, was unfolded on the in Washington on the big thing there, whatever they call it, all those blocks of the mall, And this, it had been years since there'd been a big demonstration in Washington. And there were, you know, tens of thousands of people that had come to, in some way, speak up for all of these, you know, hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands, whatever. There were people who had been dealing with this all over the world. And it was, it had got to the point where the quilt was too big to go anywhere. And so they'd bring pieces of it here and there. And the last moment that it could fit on the mall, they had a thing in Washington, and I was there. And we're walking through the streets, and they were playing canned music over the loudspeaker system. And I remember there were a few attempts by people walking to actually sing their own songs, to create the feeling of... give you the feeling that we're all in this together, and there's people singing, and there's something... magical and wonderful about the empowering, if you want to use a current term. And the people that organized the event had no knowledge of it because they hadn't been at all of these historic other events. They didn't know what the power of singing your own songs were. And so they went by what you see on TV at the ball games and all that, where everything's canned and everything's programmed and you don't actually do anything yourself, even when to cheer and when to talk and when to do this and when to do that. And it occurred to me that that's why you need to involve yourself in other people's stuff so that you get the experience so that when something happens to you and people like you, that's important to you, that you have some experience in how to make that count. Because if you don't, if you're trying to invent it for yourself every time something happens, you don't get anywhere and it seems like you're starting from scratch. And that's what I was thinking, and it's been so long since we've seen so many people out in the streets for anything.
Right.
That you see it in the Tea Party stuff. There's the people out there, but who's singing? What's the songs that are
I don't
are
know
confined
of any.
In the hearts? You know, there's canned music playing. There's you know, the sort of rah-rah stuff. But the people themselves. What are they singing? Where's their musicians? And I think that's that's because a lot of these people have not come out for other people. They're starting from scratch themselves. And good luck to them, by the way. You know, I'm for everybody getting out in the street every once in a while because I think it helps you remember what it means to be an American, to have that privilege, to get out there and say something. That's important. Doesn't matter what your position is, as far as I'm concerned. It matters more that you're willing to be there. But if you have to start from scratch every time, if you don't know what that feeling is that unites your heart and you know, gets your soul going, gets your blood boiling, and you feel like you're making a difference, that's the thing that that has been lacking in the last 20, 30 years of what we would call activism.
Very well said. So what you need to do is go to Egypt, where they have the spirit, but they
That's what I'm saying.
They need the song.
That they've got them over there.
Do they?
I guarantee you.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Our next caller is Mike in Southwest Wisconsin. Hey, Mike.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to talk to Arlo this morning. I just have something probably hundreds of people are wondering about. I'm a musician, and I play a number of things, too, like harmonica, dulcimer, accordion, and some rhythm things. But I memorized 100 tunes, but I only play by ear. And it would be useful if one could take a piece of sheet music and wonder how the song starts and how to continue on with it. And I'm wondering, I'm an older person, and I'm wondering if it's silly to take music lessons. I would like to advance to guitar and maybe dobro or mandolin or some such thing, even fiddle. But I never played the sophisticated strings. And I'm wondering if what your opinion is as far as people that, you know, want to advance on, but they can't read notes.
There was an old guy named Big Bill Brunzi, blues man. Somebody asked him one time, can you read and write music? He said, not enough to hurt my plan. And, you know, I think, you know, there's the kind of music that I learned when I was a kid. Aside from the classical music I had to learn on piano and read and write and stuff like that, but the kind I was enjoying was with my friends. Somebody'd show me a chord. Somebody else show me a lick or two, some way that you could move your fingers around, get something done easier than the way I had figured it out. I think that's the tradition that I would imagine most people learn. Every rock and roll band, every garage band, everybody on TV that we see or radio has learned that way. They've learned from friends and records. I was thinking the other day when I was younger, there was probably 40 to 50 years of recorded music that I could listen to, that I could steal stuff from. I could figure out what they were doing, you know. Now, there's, you know, 100 years of recorded music. So there's a lot more to listen to. And the kids these days, I mean, you say, Mike, you're an older person, but imagine being a kid these days where you have all of that wealth of stuff. It's no wonder that you have, you know, 13-year-old, 14-year-old kids who are playing in 6 months what it took me 10 years to figure out because they've got access to it. And so I would say just listen to the stuff you like. Sit down with friends who can figure it out, and you'll be happier in the long run. If you wanted to study music theory, something like that is fun, but don't let it interfere with your playing.
Here's a memory that somebody would like for you to share. I remember, Facebook, this is, seeing Arlo Guthrie at Summerfest when George Carlin was arrested. Do you remember the event?
Oh, man. It sticks in my mind as one of those moments. I'm sitting backstage. Carlin's on stage. And I remember as soon as he got off stage, all these big cops came and beat the crap out of him.
Ooh.
I mean, serious. And I was going like, oh,
ooh,
my God. I mean, they weren't fooling around. It wasn't just a nice, sorry, Mr. Carlin, or you're going to jail or something. They were wailing on the guy. And they put him in the squad car and drove him off or whatever. And then somebody come up to me and said, now, don't you start causing trouble. And this is the time limit that you have. And if you go over it, same thing's going to happen to you. And I was like, okay. And I thought, you know, what are you going to do in this situation? And I just went out there. I went overtime on purpose, defied them. And I was just, but I was scared. I can't say the two words that go together, but I was really,
yeah. Right, we got it.
I was scared, man. It was scary. And but sometimes you just got to, you know, look somebody in the eye and be there and do what you're going to do and let them do whatever they're going to do. And of course, over the years now, without being mean or mean-spirited or something like that, I've made friends with a lot of those same guys.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time somebody was asking me, my friend Arthur Penn, the director, just passed away about a month ago.
He did Alice's Restaurant.
He filmed Alice's Restaurant. That was after a movie he did called Bonnie and Clyde. And I remember when we were filming Alice's Restaurant, the first scenes that we were filming was me and this cop, Officer Obenheimer, who we called Officer Obie. In real life, the real cop, the real Officer Obie, is playing himself in the movie. And I'm playing myself. And we had been adversaries. And when I was thinking about Arthur Penn the other day and what kind of genius he was, it occurred to me that what he did is he put these adversaries on the stage, as it were, together at the same time. In those days, if you were a kid like me, you didn't like authority of any kind under any circumstance. And the authorities didn't like you either, by the way. It was a mutual sort of arrangement. And so here we were having to work together. And after about 2 weeks, Obie comes up to me and says, Guthrie, he says, if you hippies can get up 4 o'clock in the morning, go down and get some coffee and get your face worked on in the wardrobe and work all day until the sun goes down, you can't be all that bad. And he gave me a big smile. We hadn't said two words to each other aside from the script until that moment.
Oh.
And we became lifelong friends.
Did you really?
And the thing that was wonderful about it was that what Arthur Penn really showed in the film, what he filmed, was the proof that sometimes enemies are a matter of circumstance. Adversaries are a matter of circumstance. They're not built in. It's not real. And he filmed us becoming friends, even though that's not part of the story.
Wonderful.
And it stuck with me as a lifelong lesson.
Right. Wonderful. Thanks very much, Mike, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Here's an email of Calumet. This is from Aaron in Menasha. I attended Michigan Tech in Upper Michigan. I know that you and your father have some ties to Calumet. Can you tell us more about this connection?
There was an incident up in Calumet in Michigan in 1913 when some miners were having a Christmas party, and the mine owners had hired some thugs to go in there and break it up, and a fire or a threat of fire had occurred, and people stampeded, and some children had died. And my father wrote a song about it, and it was one of his most poignant songs, and every word of it is true. And he was really good at that, taking these historic events and stringing them into songs that were that sounded like speech, sounded like somebody talking, not somebody doing poetry, right. Not somebody doing a kind of political speaking, but as if you were just sitting around talking common talk, and put them into songs and tell the truth historically at the same time. And I remember a few years back, we got a call from somebody in Calumet wanted to put on a show at a theater called the Calumet Theater. And they said, the one condition is that you have to sing this song that your father wrote. And I had turned down show after show after show, year after year, decade after decade, when people tell you what to sing. And in this one instance, I said, you know what? I would have done it anyway. Because here we're talking about the town and the people who were there and the families that had been sort of hurt or in some way affected by this incident that had taken place 100 years ago almost now.
Mm-hmm.
And still they come. We were up there last year.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, we keep going back. And they keep putting in the contract, you got to sing the song. And I keep saying, I'll sing it anyway.
You know? They haven't learned yet. Let's go to Nancy in Phillips. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Arlo, we were at Calumet last year, and it was very moving when you sang that song to everybody, I think. So I just wanted to thank you about that.
Thank you.
Two other things. We're going to see you in Big Top this summer. We can't wait to see you.
Oh, good.
And the third thing is, you told one time about when you met Steve Goodman in the city of New Orleans, and that was a very interesting story, and we thought we'd like to hear that again if you have a moment.
Okay, I'm not going to do it on radio because all of my good stories will get used up and I won't have them for the shows. But you're right, it is a good story. I will remember to tell it when we either get to Big Top or some of the other shows around.
Okay, thanks much.
Thanks for the call. A lot of memories for me, too, as we do this show. This is an email from a friend of mine when I started radio back in Durham, North Carolina. Stephen saying he remembers his first pop concert ever, Orchestra Hall in Chicago in the late 60s. Alice's Restaurant, he says, didn't disappoint. And here's another one. Jacqueline, who wants your response to a request to sing for a particular fundraiser. He replied, yes, and my fee is whatever it was, to which the organizers of the fundraiser replied, but it's for a good cause, to which he replied, I don't sing for bad causes, and my fee is blank. I loved it when I first heard him tell this story and still love it today.
My father used to send out this thing, and the people ask him to come and sing for his, you know, raise some money for the union, whatever it was, you know, and he would write, well, yeah, I'll show up, and it'll be $20 or $25 if I show up, and realizing that he was controversial and that there was all kinds of problems associated with him politically and so forth and so on, and then he would add, and for $40 I won't show up. I think they made more money that way.
But he didn't show up. Here's one of your father's songs, which you sing, and I'd like for you to tell us about it. We're going to hear just a little bit of it, which is always one of my favorites, and I've sung it to my son, and I just love this song, The Hobo's Lullaby.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to set it up for us? We'll hear just a bit of it.
Just one of my father's favorite songs.
Was it?
Written by a guy named Gobel Reeves, and we've included it in our shows from time to time over the years when people ask. And my father and mother, you know how people have their songs, and that was one of their little songs that they loved.
Do not think about tomorrow. Let tomorrow come and go. Tonight you're in a nice warm boxcar, safe from all the wind and snow. So go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Can't you hear the steel rails humming? That's a hobo's lullaby.
Arlo Guthrie in concert with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and it will include performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday here in Milwaukee.
We were listening to also. Pete Seeger.
Oh.
He's still around. He's 90-something. He's still singing. Oh, what a joy.
He is really something, isn't he?
Mentor in life, yeah.
I would imagine, yeah. How old were you when your dad died? You were a young guy.
I was 20.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That was hard.
I remember the day I outlived my father, which is about 15 years ago now. And I said, Pop, I got one day on you. We'll see how it goes from here. And I thought, if it keeps going in any generation, if it goes just one more day, we're doing all right.
We'll take more phone calls for Arlo Guthrie in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Second hour of our program today. How much do you know about Andrew Johnson? Too bad this guy was president right after Abraham Lincoln, because he was, by all accounts, for most historians, a pretty racist fellow and kind of botched Reconstruction. Our guest will be Annette Gordon-Reed. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. She has a number of positions at Harvard University and has written a lot about Thomas Jefferson. And she is the author of Andrew Johnson. So we will learn about this president, who came from absolutely nothing. I didn't know very much about him, but this guy was poor. That will be our number two. We'll learn some more history. Always a good thing. 800-486-8655 is our number. I want to talk about your playing with the symphony for a while, because I would think you usually play guitar and you have people around you. To play with a symphony is a somewhat formal event. Do you feel like you have to alter what you do to be more formal? Do you have to wear a tuxedo and be really proper?
Man, I tried that one time for the first few shows that we did, you know, and I couldn't move. I felt like a penguin, you know, and I couldn't even play the freaking guitar, let alone sing or feel comfortable. So we dropped that part. They can get dressed up. They're used to it.
So, you know, what are you going to wear?
I'll wear something, but at least it'll be something I can move in, you know, feel free and, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, it started out one time about 15 years ago. I was playing a show at Lincoln Center in New York, And during the intermission, somebody broke into the little backstage area there and said, listen, I'm a director for a youth symphony in Washington, D.C. I can see you doing a show with an orchestra. And meanwhile, the security's running down the hall coming for this guy. And as they're dragging him away, he says, just remember me. Here's my number. You know, give me a call, whatever. I can see it. And his voice is getting farther and farther off. So I thought about it, and I gave him a call, and it turns out he was real. He was a real guy. And so we started working together. This was my buddy John Nardalillo, who will be here on stage with me. And over the next 15 years, we put together this sort of little show. And it's not like normal. I can't decide what I want to do. I don't have that freedom because the orchestra needs to.
Oh, sure.
They're not just playing along, you know, like on the back porch or something. They have to actually read the notes. And I remember just about a year ago, I'm playing with the Boston Symphony or something. And we wanted to do a version of Coming into Los Angeles that was specifically written for them. And John says to their drummer, just, you know, it's not written in the music, just play along. And the guy said, well, yes, but there's no music. He said, yeah, we understand that the part wasn't written for you. Just, you know, just play along. The guy said, but there's no music. And even the drummer couldn't just play, you know, couldn't do that on his own without the music in front of him. So that's the limitation that you have with the orchestra. They really need to see it, and they need to know in advance what it is you're going to do.
Right.
And so we've had to build in to the show moments where I can be free to be me, but at the same time cue them as to when something's going to happen. So we've tried our best to do that, but it's not as easy as just being up there by yourself.
Yeah. So you rehearse tomorrow.
We'll go over it tomorrow. We'll make sure there's some. The music is wonderful, written for the most part by a friend of mine, Jamie Burton, in London, England, who has become a dear friend and a wonderful arranger. And so some of the music is a little complicated for the orchestra. It's not simple. It's not something you could play on a synthesizer. It's something that actually takes some skill. And so most of the American orchestras that we've worked with have those skills. They're all really good these days. It's like guitars. You can't find a bad guitar these days for sale. I mean, the $200 to $400 guitars are so much better today than what they were when I was a kid. So in the same way, the orchestras are really good, and they'll be able to get this stuff, you know, just going through it one time.
Yeah. Let's go to Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Well, thank you. It's certainly an opportunity here and an honor to speak with Arlo, and worth the 55 minutes I've been listening on the phone. Arlo, would you please speak to your relationship with Hoyt Axton and say something about Hoyt?
Hoyt was my cousin. He was also a great writer and a great dear friend of mine. His mother, May, wrote Heartbreak Hotel for Elvis. Well, she was the part of the writer of that song, and Hoyt and I got to know each other back in the 60s in Los Angeles, and I traveled with him, and he was an actor people remember from some of the movies he did later on in life, but he had this wonderful baritone voice. He was even around in the 50s before the folk scare got underway, singing songs like "And they don't give a damn about a greenback dollar," you know, all of, that's Hoyt. But he also wrote "Joy to the World" and all of those songs in between that were wonderful songs. I'm actually doing, not on this show, but in the normal tour that begin at the end of this month, we're doing one of Hoyt's songs that he had written. And we used to swap songs on each other's records. You know, that I'd do some of Hoyt's and he'd do some of mine. And he was one of my buddies who passed away, what, 8 years ago now, 10 years ago, one of my dearest, dearest friends, and somebody I always enjoyed. Is crazy, and he was crazy, and he was big. He was from Oklahoma. He was like football big, and so when in the '60s, when you're a little skinny, long-haired hippie kid, It was great having football-sized friends like Hoyt who would take no crabs from anybody, no matter what. I can't go on enough about him, but I don't want to take all the time that he deserves. But he was my buddy.
Email from Paula, and this will wrap it up for us. I was fortunate to watch a lot of PBS as a child. A vivid memory is watching you and Pete Seeger at Wolf Trap. My parents had an 8-track tape of Hobo's Lullaby that we played, and my favorite song would have to be the remake of your father's song, 1913 Massacre. One thing Arlo does for me is to remind me of our country's history and who we are as a people. That's the gift he gave to me and the one that I try to share with my students. Arlo, thanks for everything.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
Very sweet. Yeah. And we thank you for everything. Well, thank you.
There's a lot of stuff that we could have talked about.
I know.
I had a lot of fun being here.
Good. We had a lot of fun with you, too. Have fun in Milwaukee.
Thank you. It'll warm up.
It'll warm up. And thanks for all you've done, all your music.
It's not going to warm up. You're lying, but it's okay.
No, I'm not kidding you. I'm not lying. I wouldn't lie to you.
Look, warming up is not going from like 5 to 15. That's not warming up.
Oh, you'd be surprised, sir. Arlo Guthrie, our guest this hour, he is performing with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. Friday, Saturday, Sunday in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. And thanks to Arlo for joining us in our Milwaukee studios. I'm sure many of you will remember this broadcast.